CFRC Live Sessions, Thursdays at 11 a.m.
Listen to sexy bands play live on air and hear exclusive interview highlights.
Sounds awesome. Tune in on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Lit. Okay. Peace out, dude.
See you Thursday.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Israel's government has approved the first phase of the Gaza ceasefire deal that includes a pause in Israeli attacks and the release of the remaining hostages held by Hamas in exchange for Palestinians detained in Israeli prisons. President Trump announced yesterday the Israeli hostages will be released from Gaza on Monday or Tuesday as he plans to travel to the Middle East. According to the deal, 250 Palestinian prisoners serving life sentences and another 1,700 people from Gaza detained in the last 2 years would be released. Hamas has demanded the release of prominent Palestinian political prisoner Marwan Barghouti, but his name was reportedly secretly removed from the prisoner exchange list by Israel. Meanwhile, the U.S. is sending about 200 troops to Israel to monitor the ceasefire deal. The Israeli military Friday confirmed the ceasefire had come into effect as soldiers retreated from parts of Gaza. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, including families that had been forced to the south, began their trek back to northern Gaza after news that Israeli forces were withdrawing. Returning Gaza City residents made their way through mounds of rubble and destroyed neighborhoods, searching for any sign of their homes and belongings, among them Vida Haraz.
I came since the morning when they said there was a withdrawal to find my home. I'm walking in the street, but I do not know where to go due to the extent of the destruction. I swear I don't know where the crossroads is or where my home is. I know that my home was leveled, but where is it? Where is it? I cannot find it. What is this? What do we do with our lives? Where should we live? Where should we stay? A house of multiple floors, but nothing was left?
Al Jazeera reports Israel's army said it would allow 600 humanitarian aid trucks carrying food, medical supplies, fuel, and other necessities daily into Gaza through coordination with the United Nations and other international groups. On Thursday, the exiled Hamas Gaza chief, Khalil al-Haya, declared an end to the war.
Today we announce that we have reached an agreement to end the war and aggression against our people and to begin implementing a permanent ceasefire. The withdrawal of the occupation forces, the entry of aid, the opening of the Rafah crossing in both directions, and the exchange of prisoners.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke today in Israel.
Today we mark one of the greatest achievements in the war of revival, the return of all of our hostages, the living and the dead as one. This way we grapple Hamas. We grapple it all around, ahead of the next stages of the plan, in which Hamas is disarmed and Gaza is demilitarized. If this can be achieved the easy way, very well. If not, it will be achieved the hard way.
In the United States, President Trump hailed his administration's ceasefire plan during a cabinet meeting Thursday as concerns mount regarding potential U.S. and foreign intervention in the rebuilding of Gaza.
Gaza is going to be slowly redone. You have tremendous wealth in that part of the world by certain countries, and just a small part of that, what they make will do wonders for Gaza.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Haifa, Diana Bhutu, Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization. She's just recently written a piece for The Guardian. It's headlined, "A Magic Pill Made Israeli Violence Invisible. We Need to Stop Swallowing It." And I'm Judd Araki, is a senior Israel-Palestine analyst at the International Crisis Group, joining us from London. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Diana Bhutu, let's begin with you. First, your response to this ceasefire hostage deal that's just been approved by the Israeli government and Hamas.
Well, first, Amy, it's really quite repulsive that Palestinians have had to negotiate an end to their genocide. It should have been that the world put sanctions on Israel to stop the genocide rather than forcing Palestinians to negotiate an end to it. At the same time, we're also negotiating an end to the famine, a famine that Israel, again, created. Who are we negotiating with? The very people who created that famine. And so it's really repugnant that this is the position that Palestinians have been forced to be in. And so while people here are elated, happy that the bombs have stopped, we're also at the same time worried because we've seen that the international community time and again has abandoned us. Everybody is happy that the Israelis are going home, but nobody's talking about the more than 11,000 Palestinians who are currently languishing in Israeli prisons, being starved, being tortured, being raped. Many of them are hostages picked up after October of 2023, being held without charge, without trial, and nobody at all is talking about them. So while people are happy that the bombs have stopped, we know that Israel's control has not at all stopped. And Israel's made it clear that it's going to continue to control every morsel of food that comes into Gaza. It's going to control every single construction item that comes into Gaza. And it's going to continue to maintain a military occupation over Gaza. This is not a peace agreement. This is not an end to the occupation. And I think it's so important for us that we keep our eyes on Gaza and start demanding that Israel be held to account, not only for the genocide, but for all of these decades of occupation that led to this in the first place.
Can you talk about the exchange of hostages, Israeli hostages dead and alive, and Palestinian prisoners? According to the Hamas Gaza chief, I believe they're saying all women and children, Palestinian women and children picked up over these last 2 years, or is it beyond, are going to be released. And then, of course, there are the well over 1,000 prisoners who are going to be released.
No, not quite. So there are 250 who are political prisoners who are going to be released. And that list just came out about a little over an hour ago. But there are also 1,700 Palestinians solely from Gaza who are going to be released. And these were people, these are doctors, these are nurses, these are journalists, and so on, who Israel picked up after the 7th of October, 2023, and has been holding as hostages. These are the people that are going to be released. There are still thousands more, Amy, that are from the West Bank that we do not know what is going to happen to them. And so while the focus is just on the people in Gaza, and again, there is no path for freeing all of those thousands of Palestinians who are languishing in Israeli prisons, being starved, being tortured, being raped. What's going to happen to them? Who's going to be focusing on them? I don't think that it's going to be this U.S. administration.
I want to talk about the West Bank in a minute. More than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank just over the last 2 years. But I first want to get Amjad Araki's response to this deal that has now been signed off on. I mean, watching the images of tens of thousands, this sea of humanity, of Palestinians going south to north to see what they can find of their homes in places like Gaza City, not to mention who's trapped in the rubble. We say something well over 60,000 Palestinians have been killed, but we don't know the real number. It could be hundreds of thousands.
Indeed, Amy. And to kind of continue off of Deanna's points, This is a deal that really should have been made long, long ago. We've known that the parameters of this truce have been on the table for well over a year, if not since the very beginning of the war, what used to define as an all-for-all deal, the idea that Hamas would release all hostages in exchange for a permanent ceasefire. And the reasons for the constant foiling of it are quite evident. And it's important to recognize this, not for the sake of just lamenting the lives, the many lives that have been lost and the massive destruction that could have been averted, but it needs to really inform the next steps going forward. The biggest takeaway of what's happening right now is that in order for a ceasefire to be sustained, in order for Gaza to be saved from further military assault, you need massive political pressure. And we've seen this really build up in the past weeks and months. You saw this, for example, from European governments, which even through the symbolic recognition of Palestinian statehood was very much venting their frustration with Israeli conduct in the war. The fact that the EU was actually starting to contemplate more sort of punitive measures against Israel, such as partial trade suspensions, potential sanctions against Israel. We saw this building up over the past few weeks. Arab states have started to use much of their leverage, especially after Israel's strike on Doha or Hamas's offices in Doha. We started seeing Gulf and other Arab and Muslim states come forward to President Trump at the UN saying that Israeli aggression cannot continue like this. And most crucially is, of course, President Trump himself and of Washington finally saying that it needs to put its foot down to stop this war, which we've heard repeatedly from Trump himself, but this is really the first time since the January ceasefire agreement where Trump has really insisted that this come to an end. Now, there's much to be sort of debated about the Trump plan itself, but this aspect of the truce cannot continue and certainly cannot save Palestinian lives unless that pressure is maintained. The concern now is that that pressure will recede or alleviate because there's now a deal that's signed. But actually, in order to enforce it, that pressure really needs to be maintained.
What do you think was the turning point, Amjad? The bombing of Qatar? Now, I mean, the New York Times had an expose that Trump knew before, not just in the midst of the bombing, that Israel was bombing their ally to try to kill the Hamas leadership. But do you think that was the turning point?
It certainly might have expedited, I think, a lot of factors that were already building up. As I said, pressure had been mounting against Israel for quite a while. There was really outrage, not just at the continuance of the military assaults, but the policy of starvation, which was very evident on the ground, and Israel's complete refusal to let in aid, its failed project through the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. So this had all been building, but I do think the strike on Doha really pushed Arab states to say that enough is enough, to see them really meet all together with President Trump and create a bit more of a united position to insist that this really couldn't go on, I think has really signaled that Israel really crossed a certain line geopolitically. Now, of course, that line should have been recognized as being crossed well before because of the facts on the ground in Gaza. But I do think that this has helped to kind of push things over the edge a bit more assertively. There are also speculations about Trump, of course, trying to have his name in for the Nobel Peace Prize and potentially other factors. But I do think that the timing of this, again, regardless of what ended up pushing it over the line, it is unfortunate that it has really taken this long. And it's really up to global powers and foreign governments to recognize that in order to make sure that this stays, that they really need to keep that pressure up.
And Amjad Araki, the core demand of the ceasefire is that Hamas disarm and end its rule. What security guarantees is Hamas seeking for its own members to lay down their arms and not face a wave of arrests or assassinations? How is this going to work? And talk about who you see running Gaza.
So these things are still a bit unclear. So throughout the ceasefire talks, Hamas has kept insisting about the idea of U.S. guarantees that Israel will not end the war. But there's never really any clear, concrete way to prove this. And as we've seen before, like in the January ceasefire deal and in much of the ceasefire talks, even if President Trump expresses his desire to see an end to the war, oftentimes he would still hand the steering wheel to Prime Minister Netanyahu. And if Netanyahu decided that he wanted to thwart the ceasefire talks, if he wanted to relaunch military assaults with and the Israeli military and the government would back it, then Trump and Washington would fall into line and amplify those calls, and even President Trump himself would sort of cheer on the military assaults. And so this factor has certainly weighed a lot on Hamas. But I do think there's a combination of pressure, the fact that Arab states have insisted on Hamas to try to show, at least signal, certain flexibility, even though many of its demands have been quite consistent throughout the war. But the fact that I think Hamas is now feeling that there's also a bit more pressure on Israel to actually ensure that they at least tried to take the gamble that they will not return to war. And in regards to decommissioning and disarmament, publicly Hamas has placed a red line around this right to bear arms. But historically and even recently, they do say that they are willing to have conversations about decommissioning as long as it's tied to a political framework, especially one that's tied to the establishment of a Palestinian state. Now, one can really debate how much this process is actually quite feasible, and obviously the Israeli government and much of the Israeli public is quite adamant in its opposition against Palestinian statehood, but Hamas may at least offer some space for those conversations to be had. There's discussions about it potentially giving up what it might describe as its larger or more offensive weaponry, like rockets or anti-tank missiles. And there's bigger questions around firearms. But I think it's important to put this question not as a black and white issue, as something that has to come first in the political process, as Israel is demanding, but one that requires trust building and confidence building in the rubric of a process of Palestinian self-determination. This is important not just in the case of Palestine, but in across many conflicts around the world where the question of decommissioning, about establishing one rule, one gun, one government for a society, requires that kind of process. So it shouldn't just be a policy of destroying and military assaults and so on. You do need to engage in these questions in good faith.
There are so many questions, Yanibutu, and this first stage of the ceasefire hostage deal is really the only one that Netanyahu addressed today in his speech. You're usually in Ramallah. You spend a lot of time on the West Bank. Where does this leave the Palestinian Authority? I don't think the West Bank is talked about in this deal. And what about the fact that we're looking at pictures of Netanyahu surrounded by Steve Witkoff on one side and Jared Kushner, who has talked about, as we know, famously referred to Gaza as very valuable waterfront property?
Well, I think that this plan was really an Israeli plan, and it was repackaged and branded as a Trump plan. And you can see just in the text of it and the way that all of the guarantees were given to the Israelis and none given to the Palestinians, it's really an Israeli plan. But beyond that, it's important to keep in mind that when Trump was going around and talking about this plan, that he consulted with everybody but Palestinians. He didn't talk to Mahmoud Abbas. He didn't even let Mahmoud Abbas go to the UN to deliver his speech before the UN. I'm pretty certain he didn't speak to the UN representative, the Palestinians representative to the UN. And so this is, once again, we've got a plan in which people are talking about Palestinians, but never talking to Palestinians. So again, this is very much an Israeli plan repackaged as a Trump plan and branded as a Trump plan. In terms of them looking at Gaza as being prime real estate, this is not at all different from the way that they've done it in the past. And this is not at all the way that Israel has looked at Palestine. And this is because this is the way that colonizers look at land that isn't theirs. They ignore the history of the place. Gaza has an old history. It has some of the oldest churches, I think the second oldest church in the world. It has some of the oldest mosques. It has an old civilization. We want Gaza to be Gaza. We don't want it to be Dubai or any other place. We want it to be Gaza. And so the idea of somehow turning it into prime real estate, this is the mentality of somebody who's coming from outside. This is the way that colonizers think. This isn't the way that the indigenous think. And so you can see in this plan that it's not only the idea of the outside coming in, but they certainly didn't consult Palestinians at all. As for what's going to happen to the Palestinian Authority, it's clear that they don't want the Palestinian Authority in the Gaza Strip. And it's clear that they do want to have a foreign authority in the Gaza Strip. But once again, Amy, when is it that Palestinians get to decide our own future? Are we really going back to the to the era of colonialism when other people get to decide our future? And that's what this plan is really all about.
Well, we're going to be continuing to cover this story. President Trump is expected to be there for the signing of the ceasefire in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt on Sunday. And the hostages and prisoners are expected to be released on Monday or Tuesday. As President Trump celebrates the ceasefire hostage deal at the Gaza summit in Egypt yesterday, major questions remain over the deal and what happens next. We turn now to Khaled El-Gindi. He is visiting scholar at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies and advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, author of Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. Welcome to Democracy Now! Khaled, if you can start off by saying, what exactly was signed? We watched, you know, President Trump and the Egyptian president, al-Sisi, sign a document. What is in this plan at this point?
Well, I think the plan is like what we saw announced last week. It is very short on details, except in terms of, this very initial phase that hostages have to be released within 72 hours, followed by Palestinian prisoners and hostages, and of course, the cessation of hostilities. Beyond that, the document is sort of big on generalities and, vague statements about the need for peace and security and prosperity for Israelis and Palestinians. It doesn't say much, frankly. The president likes to talk about this plan as in very grandiose terms, ending a 3,000-year conflict, which, of course, is completely false. But there's a lot of fluff, frankly, in terms of the substance of the plan itself.
And Khaled El-Gindi, nearly 2,000 prisoners were released by Israel, but there was one who was not released. Israel absolutely refused the request of Hamas to release Marwan Barghouti, probably the most famous of all the Palestinian prisoners that Israel's held, widely respected by all political groups. Why do you think that Israel was so insistent on not releasing Barghouti?
Well, I mean, they have consistently refused to release him, as you pointed out. I think the main reason is, like any colonial power, Israel wants to keep the people that they subjugate weak and divided. And of course, they are now. There is a 17-year division between Hamas and Fatah, between Gaza and the West Bank. And that has really crippled and handicapped any kind of diplomatic effort or even in terms of Palestinian politics. They've been paralyzed. So the last thing Israel wants is someone to emerge who could unify Palestinians, inspire the national movement, possibly even renew the national movement in some way. And so right now, Marwan Barghouti is the person who is most likely to do those things. And so they have to keep him from playing that role as, emerging as a unifying leader.
Khaled El-Gindi, you've said you're not concerned about Hamas trying to remain in power, but that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and his leadership will try to insinuate itself in Gaza and monopolize the conversation. If you can explain, and also, do you think part of why Netanyahu didn't attend the summit, though he was invited, was not to be seen with Mahmoud Abbas? Others said it was because the Turkish President Erdogan said he would turn his flight around and go back to Turkey if Netanyahu was there.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of, the first part of your question
was what's going to happen? What is in the deal around Hamas control of Gaza?
Yeah, I think I think what's important is for Palestinians as a collective to discuss the future of Gaza. And that includes everything from rebuilding, governance, security, you know, the connection with the West Bank. All of those things are not up to any one particular party, not up to Hamas and not up to Mahmoud Abbas to pursue on their own. And I think Hamas made that clear when they accepted the Trump plan, when they talked about things like disarming or, you know, all of these other aspects, they couched it in the language of a Palestinian consensus. These are matters to be discussed internally. And I think that was wise. It's wise for Hamas because it gives them cover to be able to do those things. But it's also wise politically, and I think necessary for Palestinians to rebuild their national movement. You cannot have, right now, Mahmoud Abbas is deeply, deeply unpopular. So importing his very unpopular leadership into Gaza is not going to be very effective. You need to have a broad Palestinian consensus that can move forward together. And so that was the thrust of that point that I was making about not letting Mahmoud Abbas or really anyone monopolize the process. As far as Netanyahu, yeah.
No, I just wanted to ask you, there have been reports that have emerged since the ceasefire that there have been armed clashes between Hamas and other groups within Gaza. What do we know about this? And of course, most Americans don't know that Hamas is not the only resistance force within Gaza.
Right. It's not the only resistance force. It's also not the only armed force. There are armed elements. There are criminal elements. There are tribal elements that are not political, but are pursuing narrow self-interests. And there are agents of chaos. There are people who seek to exploit the power vacuum that existed in Gaza and that still exists. For the last 2 years, we saw, for example, there are many groups that loot aid that was coming in. And some of, in many cases, those criminal elements were at least provided some cover by the Israeli military. And so what Hamas says it's doing now is first is establishing some kind of law and order, in preventing chaos and lawlessness, which is, you know, something that is very normal when there is a power vacuum and when there is enormous death and destruction and despair and trauma. There are people who emerge who want to take advantage of that. So on the one hand, it is to prevent chaos. There is, I think, an element also of settling scores, particularly with people who are seen as collaborators with Israel. They're not necessarily being tried and, receiving due process, but there is some kind of process that may not meet basic standards. But I think this is what Hamas is trying to do. I don't necessarily think that they are trying to hold on to power. I think they are trying to demonstrate that they are brokers and will be part of decision-making going forward, but not necessarily the sole governing authority as they were before October 7th.
Khaled El-Gindi, what about the fact that, Palestinians continue to be killed, at least five yesterday, by Israeli forces, apparently. What stops Israel from engaging in a full-scale assault, just moving back in, as happened before the last ceasefire?
Yeah, I think there's nothing that stops them. Barring, of course, the president of the United States. And we saw how that played out in March. The president gave Netanyahu basically a green light to destroy that ceasefire after the first phase. That may or may not happen this time. We don't know. My sense is that President Trump seems to be much more serious about it this time for his own calculations. But you know, this is typical of how Israel relates to a ceasefire. We saw this in Lebanon, where even today, almost a year after a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, Israel still acts more or less freely in Lebanon, as it does in Syria and other places, and as it certainly will continue to do in Gaza. It will strike people wherever and whenever it feels it needs to. And the pattern has been, as long as it's not, you know, on a massive scale, that will be tolerated. But that can also be ratcheted up gradually, right? It can be five over the last few days, and then that number can increase. And there's this kind of, you know, drip effect that desensitizes the international community, which has already stopped paying attention to the issue at this point. And so, but the plan doesn't have any restraints on Israel. There's no timetable for Israel to withdraw. So it's really up to the
Palestinian statehood, Khalid.
Sorry?
Any discussion of Palestinian statehood?
Well, there's a lot of discussion
in the ceasefire hostage deal that was signed yesterday.
There is a reference to in aspirational terms about a Palestinian state, but it is not. There are no steps toward a state. We know that Israel completely rejects the idea of a Palestinian state. So it's not really on the table as part of this plan in the way, let's say, that previous peace plans like the 2003 roadmap had very concrete steps that needed to be taken in order to reach a Palestinian state. Now it's merely stated as a Palestinian aspiration, but is not something that is part of.
Very quickly, the Arab and Muslim countries, their role, apparently Indonesia in rebuilding. Of course, there's Saudi Arabia. There's a meeting going now in Sussex in England about rebuilding. What is the role of Arab and Muslim countries also in what has been talked about as an international stabilization force?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is an expectation that Arab and Muslim countries are going to play a very large role in both of those, financing the reconstruction of Gaza, particularly the Arab Gulf states, of course, because they have considerable resources and a direct stake in the stability of the region. And they're also being talked about as candidates, you know, to contribute forces in this international stabilization force. But we don't have clear commitments on either front. I think we're much more likely to see movement on pledges and, you know, donor assistance to, you know, contributing to a reconstruction fund of some kind. I think it will be much harder to convince countries to commit troops, at least until there is more clarity on what the mission or mandate of this force is going to be, under whose command. What sort of role are they going to play? What will be its relationship with the Israeli military? Because the last thing that any of these countries want to do is to be seen as an occupying power or as doing the dirty work of the current occupying power, which, of course, is Israel. So those are things that are going to be worked out over the medium term, I think.
This is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, October 10, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This This week on the show, Nick Seabrook sits down with Anori Roy, the co-founder of Canadian Journalists for Justice in Palestine, to discuss why many journalists in Canada remain hesitant to cover Palestine. They explore how the organization is helping newsrooms report on Gaza with greater fairness and accuracy, and the broader efforts underway to promote ethical journalism across the country. Here are Anori Roy and Nick Seabrook in conversation. Take a listen.
Anori, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about the history of Canadian Journalists for Justice in Palestine?
Of course. So CJJP was founded with the aim of being able to speak truth to power about what's happening both in Palestine with regards to Israel's genocide and its onslaught, but also with regards to what's happening in Canadian media. The complicity of most media outlets, especially mainstream media outlets, in functionally erasing the war crimes and genocidal actions of the Israeli army, of treating the press as a mouthpiece for Israeli propaganda, and for failing to acknowledge the scale of the tragedy and the complicity of Canada in that tragedy. We wanted to be able to create an environment where journalists could act in solidarity with Palestinian journalists, could speak to the infringement against the rights of reporters everywhere to be able to do their job and to report on the truth, and to highlight that Canadian media has a chronic problem with naming the perpetrator. And so in that capacity, we joined together. You know, there are lots of members of the organization who are public. There are also members of the organization who are from some of these mainstream newsrooms and can't speak out and only work privately or under the radar because they know that they'd be punished for being part of something that is essentially a press freedom exercise and activity and an organization. So we wanted a place for journalists to be able to work in solidarity towards those causes. And we're quite new. We were only founded earlier this summer. And so it's been only a little while so far, but we're hoping that we can be effective in making our presence known and providing a refuge for journalists who are concerned about this, and also in pushing newsrooms to do better.
Absolutely. And in terms of pushing newsrooms to do better, can you go a little bit more into some of the examples of problems that you've seen with reporting from Canadian journalists on what's happening in Gaza, on the genocide? It's obviously something that, as of today, you know, we've been covering for 2 years now. So can you tell us a little bit about how coverage of this story has been treated and how it's evolved over the past 2 years?
Of course. So we've seen all of the problems that that are commonly talked about when it comes to media complicity in matters of oppression sort of across the board. We see a universal reliance on passive voice, right? In the same way that news outlets have reported on police violence previously or colonial violence as being, you know, a person was shot or a person was arrested as opposed to police did the shooting. In the same way now you see Gaza is bombed or Gaza is starved as opposed to acknowledging who is doing the starving and the bombing. So that is one of the sort of fundamental issues. And this matter of, you know, it's such a clear violation of journalism standards because we know that journalism generally never uses the passive voice. The passive voice is something that editors will frequently rail against, except when it comes to issues like this. So, you know, there's the matter of which sources they choose to use. You so rarely see Palestinian voices forefronted in coverage of the region, but you often see voices from the Israeli Defense Forces and Israeli government officials. You often see voices from Zionist organizations who claim to speak on behalf of the entire Jewish community when there is a sizable population of the Jewish community in Canada who are opposed to the Israeli government's actions and who are trying to speak out in favor of peace and who are being overshadowed by organizations who have a strictly pro-Israel stance and who treat any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism. And those voices are forefronted more often than any other in mainstream media, which is an injustice to the Jewish community as much as any other. You see significant reduction over time
in reporting on the scale of protest, the scale of dissent against the genocide and the war. You know, more and more people are realizing the extent of the damage and the harm resulting from the genocide. And yet the news coverage would make it seem like it's become an issue of the past. And so across the board, you know, when there is coverage, who's being covered, how it's being covered, and whether it's being covered or not, these are some of the issues that we see taking place. And we also know that inside newsrooms, journalists are being silenced, are being alienated and isolated and told off for doing their jobs and for trying to speak up about Palestine and pushing for better coverage in their newsrooms. We know that there are journalists who have left their outlets because they can no longer live with the complicity that they're being forced into by their editors. We know that there are journalists who desperately are trying to make a change on the inside and are being thwarted at every level by upper management or by the threat of funders pulling out. And so there is a genuine effort to silence conversations about Palestine in Canadian newsrooms and in newsrooms that ostensibly are fairly progressive or considered progressive outwardly, at least. And so the scale, it sort of, it penetrates every level of reporting from what it's like in the newsroom to what's reported on and what's not.
And I'm glad that you brought that up about the issue of the passive voice, because it might be something that, you know, the someone who didn't train in journalism or worked in journalism doesn't quite understand the significance of. But for those of us who are journalists and been trained as journalists, it is something very significant, especially in an age, you know, of Donald Trump calling media fake news and attacking news credibility, where it is something that journalists take quite seriously, you know, being unbiased, being, you know, meeting professional standards. So to see things like the use of the passive voice in this case is really stark for those within the industry. And the conformity to that, to the use of the passive voice and other issues in that reporting, is that journalists policing themselves for fear of backlash, or is that coming from corporate masters, advertisers, funders, pressures from people outside of the profession?
Well, it's a good question, because when it becomes a chilling effect of this nature, when you see the problem take place at every level, you start to realize that, you know, maybe at first it was about someone from up top, a manager, you know, sort of sending down some kind of decree on, we don't use the word Palestine in our coverage, for example. But over time, we know that it also has an effect on, it wears down what a journalist is capable of doing, right? So if, you know, 5 times out of 10, it is a corporate manager or a funder or the fundraising, the member of the board who is, you know, in charge of fundraising, who says that, you know, we can't have coverage of this nature because of its incendiary political potential, or because it seems biased, or what have you, the sort of myriad excuses that we use instead of openly saying, well, this makes Israel look bad. You know, 5 times out of 10, if that comes down the chain and trickles into how an editor edits a story, then the next 3 times out of 10, you'll also have the writers start to be like, all right, if I include these words in a story, I'm going to be worn down. I know I'm going to face the same battle again, so I might as well just not include it at all. And then the last 2 times out of 10, the writer will be like, well, I don't really want to report on the subject anymore because, you know, I know it's not going to get anywhere. I'm going to be stuck in an editorial process forever. I'm going to, you know, look bad in front of my bosses because I'll be seen as a troublemaker for pushing back against this. So it becomes this really profound, really ingrained chilling effect, where it starts up top and then it starts to affect how journalists sees their job, sees their role in an organization, sees their future in the industry. And then that journalist comes to a crossroads where they say, well, I can either never write for this publication again if I'm a freelancer, or I can choose to quit if I work there as a staff, or I be quiet and I don't say anything about this and I secretly have a problem with it, but I never bring that up to my bosses. And then ultimately I take my paycheck home and I have a stable job, but at what cost to my moral character or to the quality of my work? And this is why I, you know, really early on, it's crazy how long this has been happening, but really early on in January 2024, when we had a vigil for the journalists who were killed up until that point, we talked about the fact that this was what journalists in Canadian newsrooms were going through was a form of moral injury. Moral injury being a circumstance in which you are, the system forces you not to do your job properly, not to to meet your moral standards properly, because you will be punished so severely. And in a scarcity mindset and a scarcity atmosphere like the Canadian journalism scene, losing a job, it doesn't mean that there's a possibility you'll never get another one, or at least that's what we're told and what we're reminded, in order to make us hyper conscious and hyper careful about the way we operate in news spaces. But over time, that sort of, it builds up into an inability, a forced inability to meet the moral standard of your work. And that is a serious workplace concern. It's a serious concern for journalistic freedoms. And it's a self-policing that becomes deeply harmful for your psyche and your conscience. And some reporters feel that very acutely. Others, I believe, have probably just blocked themselves off from it. And so that's why some people seem so comfortable with, you know, sleeping at night, despite their irresponsible reporting.
And also, I just wanted to talk about outside pressures, because I'm not sure if this is something that you've seen, but I know here at Rabble, we have seen a dramatic increase in requests from writers. We're a publication that's almost 25 years old. So we've had a lot of writers throughout history, and all of our stuff is online. It's all searchable. And we've had freelance journalists, just people who wrote op-eds for us in the past. We've seen increasing requests for that content to be taken down, especially if it's related to Israel and seen as being controversial. Are these stories that you've heard as well, that people are feeling afraid to write about it due to outside consequences, outside threats?
Absolutely. You know, some of the most targeted threats come from organizations like Honest Reporting Canada, which is an organization with charitable status whose, I can't speak to what their official mandate is, but it seems like one of their primary modes of operation is to repeatedly harass and spotlight journalists who have been reporting responsibly on Palestine. They frequently target reporters who manage to include, you know, mentions of the war and the genocide in their reporting, or who report positively on Palestinian art or culture or history. And that is fundamentally, and it's an infringement on you know, the journalists' rights. It's an infringement on press freedom and on the truth. But it is also a surprisingly effective force among editors. Editors are really afraid of getting an email from Honest Reporting or getting an email from Honest Reporting's followers, of which there are many. I believe that the way they work is to send out sort of action alerts, which indicate that particular reporters should be frequently harassed, or reporters' editors should be reached out to and told about what the reporter's been up to on social media, even if the editor is very well aware. And out of fear of, you know, being the subject of that harassment or targeting, editors will police their reporters preemptively, right? And so we know that organizations like Honest Reporting Canada make it a lot harder to do your job in reporting well on Palestine, reporting responsibly and fairly on Palestine. So I think that that question of what are the outside influences and why do they have such influence? I think part of what's so interesting is that I don't think for any other issue we would let an outside influence have such power over how we shape our editorial content. There is a sort of fundamental dehumanization of Palestine and a valorization of Israel and the Israeli government and the army in newsrooms and in mainstream newsrooms that is, it sets up journalists even from a very young age to know that I will never be able to report peacefully on this thing because I will be targeted. When we had an open letter that went up at the same time as the vigil last January, where we specifically talked about, you know, this solidarity that Canadian journalists had with Palestinian journalists who were being killed, the demand for Canadian newsrooms to do better and to not be complicit. And we had 300 signatories, and Honest Reporting put out a press release about our letter in which they specifically picked photos of some of the youngest signatories. We had some signatories who were either Toronto Star interns or former interns who had just recently become part of the industry, very early career people. mostly racialized people. And also a lot of Muslim and Arab sounding names. And honest reporting, out of 300 signatories, I believe it was 200 when we started and 300 by the sort of peak of the signing. But out of 200 signatories, honest reporting picked the images of sort of four or five signatories who were sort of scattered throughout the list, because I was the second name on the list and my photo was not there. And it was specifically, I don't know how to describe it, except that it came across to me personally like there was an intent in going after the most vulnerable reporters who had put their names on the list. And it's really concerning that from such a young age, reporters are being targeted for setting some kind of moral boundary in their work or in their presence in the industry. And it really makes you wonder about what will that young journalist do the next time they're at a moral crossroads like this? Will they feel safe to be able to speak their truth?
Absolutely. The threats that Canadian journalists are facing are real and oppressive, having a chilling effect on the industry. Also, in a way, pales in comparison to what the threats that Palestinian journalists on the ground are facing. We're speaking today on October 7th, the second year anniversary of the start of the war. And in 2024, on the second anniversary of the start of the war in Ukraine, there have been less than 20 journalists who've been killed covering that conflict. Today, on the second anniversary of the war in Gaza, the genocide, it's well over 200 journalists who have been killed, it's estimated. And just what are the conversations happening within your organization? You mentioned the visual you did in 2024, but what are some of the other conversations you're having about the effect on the industry that this rate of attack on journalists specifically in the war is having?
Well, there's a lot that we'd like to be able to do. We're a relatively young organization, and there's a lot that we have planned as our membership grows. We're currently 50 members plus, and we really want to meet the urgency of the moment. There is a sense of what can we do not only to be able to address this egregious crime, this egregious war crime and a violation of the sort of very fundamental human principle of the right to report, and also what can we do to create long-standing change, so we can put out statements and press releases and hold press conferences to be able to shine a light on the scale of the problem right now and Canada's complicity in it. We can try to hold newsrooms accountable, to work with news workers, unions, to be able to try and have some kind of change in how newsrooms operate from the inside. But how can we make long-standing change as well? Because of course, it's been 2 years of genocide. It's been, decades and decades of settler colonialism and violence. And Canadian media's complicity has gone on so much longer than just the last 2 years as well, right? And so we really, those are the questions we're trying to figure out right now. When we talk about what can we put out for October 7th to be able to speak to fellow media workers who still remain silent, even though it's so clear that we have crossed any sort of last moral boundary, right? We've crossed any line that we could have drawn has been crossed in what's happened. And if you don't speak up now, it's likely you probably never will, because I don't know what more needs to happen for you to speak up. And so in part of our thinking when we were trying to figure out what our messaging would be for October 7th, of which there's discussion about whether, is there a way to reach newsrooms, to be able to reach journalists and tell them to be responsive. But there was also a sense that I don't know if we can. I think we've reached everybody who will feasibly say something. And if they choose not to say something now, no amount of convincing from us will do anything. So there's a constant sort of push and pull in trying to figure out where our efforts can be most effective, who we can reasonably sway, at this point. And I don't have a lot of concrete answers right now, because we move between sort of, responsiveness, like being responsive to being able to create a reporting guide on how to report on any of the ceasefire agreements that happen in the next few weeks, and how to a reporting guide on what not to say about October 7th, right? Like don't say that all of this started on October 7th, 2023, because it's gone on so much longer than that. There are ways that we can put out guides, but there's also a question of, we're all volunteers. No one's being paid for this work. We're all doing it alongside our day jobs as journalists. And sometimes there is a genuine doubt about whether our efforts can be will be well spent trying to reach journalists who are sometimes seemingly immovable. So I know that we're balancing, you know, working with unions and with other writers' organizations to be able to make moves within the industry. I know we're also working to make our presence known in the community, to make, you know, non-journalists know that our efforts are being put towards and a freer and more open media landscape around Palestine. But it's really hard to know what exactly the right move or the most necessary move in any moment is, because sometimes it feels like we're up against a sort of massive Goliath of a system that is unwielding.
Absolutely. And, you know, just in the few minutes we have left, I do want to talk about one of your recent efforts to raise awareness. It was the Toronto Palestinian Film Festival, which was last week in Toronto, of course. And one of the events that you were involved with involved virtual reality headsets. And I just want to let our audience know, as a bit of professional disclosures, that my partner is the owner of the company that provided the headsets. So can you tell me a little bit about the film festival and what you guys were up to there?
Yes. So we did a VR pop-up exhibit with in association with the Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy. So they are an organization based in Palestine, and they run these virtual reality sessions in which people can get to see on the ground footage from different parts of Palestine. So places like Rafah and Khan Yunis and Gaza, but also, you know, the Damascus Gate in Jerusalem, different parts of the West Bank. And the goal is to be able to give people as immersive as possible an experience of what life is like on the ground in Palestine, both the immense scale of the destruction in Gaza and also the scale of the sort of everyday casual oppression in occupied territory. And it was a beautiful experience. So basically, we set up a little booth in the lobby of the TIFF Lightbox. And we, you know, people who are coming in to see Toronto Palestine Film Festival programming, they stopped by the booth, they tried the VR headset. It was 5 minutes a turn. And it basically gave people this really intimate look at what life is like on the ground. There were tours from Palestinian journalists and social media personalities like Bissan, who everybody sort of knew and recognized. People came away from it incredibly emotional. We had, you know, people who had never sort of seen anything on that scale or who had only seen it on the news. We also had people who were from Gaza and Jerusalem and who were extremely emotional, knowing that this sort of immersive 5-minute experience was one of the few ways they would actually be able to go back in some sense, you know? And so there was a young Palestinian woman who told us that her father had been born in Jerusalem and that the VR experience of getting a tour of Damascus Gate was the closest she would be able to get anytime soon to being able to go back to her father's homeland, to her homeland. And so it was incredibly successful. And I was nervous because I thought in some sense it would be considered facile, you know, like, oh, like, you're showing me a video on a headset. But it really moved people in a way that I was so glad for. And it was a way to show the community that, you know, journalists, there are journalists who care. Like, we're not all sitting silent and complicit. We are moved and we're trying to do something about it.
Inori Roy, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Nick. Thank you so much.
That's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. To listen to this episode or any previous episode again, you can go to CQUT's website at cqut.ca and click on the name of the show to see the archive. You can also find the link to this archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
on out October 16th, 17th, and 18th for two mega sales under one roof. The Quality Inn Hotel at 33 Benson Street is hosting its Zara-branded outerwear sale and mega sports sale featuring jackets, parkas, jerseys, hoodies, toques, and more just in time for those cooler temperatures. Students get a 10% discount on everything. Head out to the Quality Inn 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Thursday and Friday, and then on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. for great deals on outerwear and sports apparel.